The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. So, welcome to Secure in Mind. Today's guest is a very special guest who I'm speaking to remotely. She is currently based in the UK, but I believe she works all around the world and advises and travels all around the world as well. Her name is Hanan Bujemi. And in this episode, we will be having a great discussion about a range of topics very close to my heart and my interest and some of my background. Hanan, I'm going to turn it over to you because I guess what we generally look for at the beginning of an episode is to break down the personal background and the reason as to why you became who you are, I guess personally and professionally, or it could be intertwined or any way you want to present that. And then we'll jump into two or three broader topics and broader areas of your of what you're doing these days. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Nick. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Hanan Bujemi, and I'm from Morocco, but I'm based in the UK. I think everything I did so far revolves around one platform, that is the internet. And I think that's the reason why I landed a slot in this interesting podcast. So my work generally has been around the field of internet governance. I worked in the field for the last 15, 16 years. And I think what intrigued me, you know, to be part of the global policy process is, you know, how the internet functions and the impact it created in a short span on various aspects of our lives and economy. So I do a lot of activities, but the internet is the center of my work, my research, my academic credentials, even though I'm not a technical person, which means I haven't got a technical background. So I'm no engineer, I'm no programmer, I'm just a technology novice, as I call myself. Mm-hmm. Always intrigued by innovative solutions and new stuff in general. And that's why you'd see me all the time either researching, working in a field that is closely linked, you know, to the internet. So in a nutshell, that's what I did. My background, believe it or not, is business administration. I do have a degree.
You're the one with that degree.
Yeah, business administration, economics. So I did a bit of everything. I've got credentials in English as in higher education. And obviously, I moved on to international law. So I've got a master's in international law and another master's in diplomacy, but with a specialization on internet governance. My experience ranges from, you know, project management and large scale program management specific to the field of internet policy. But also, I contribute to various processes, including, for example, the Freedom Online Coalition. I think that's where I met Nick in Germany, where I advise members of the coalition on issues specific to internet freedom.
Okay, well, let's pull that apart. Just as a preface to this this question, the listener base of this podcast are very varied. So this includes my mum and my dad, to people in very senior positions in European Union, in military, highly technical people, people in diplomacy and politics. Sometimes the terminologies may be familiar to one area, but not familiar to the others. Internet governance, what do you mean by that? And how does that work when you go in and advise people who work within or who are involved in the Freedom Online Coalition organization or body? Tell us a bit more about that. Let's pull that apart.
Yeah, this is like the million-dollar question that everybody asks when I mention what I do for a living. And I can tell you this, it used to be a lot worse, you know, when nobody could really relate to to the theme, everybody knew about the internet, but most people would associate governance with governments. And I think one of the first things that we do with anybody who wants to be involved in the field is the terminology and the definition. And actually, the governance of the internet intrigued me when I was doing my academic research, and I didn't know it even existed until I started, you know, one of my theses of my master. I asked the question, so who controls the internet, basically? Who governs it? Who, you know, kind of has the hand into managing it, administrating it? You can put it in various terms. But actually, internet governance, it's a set of principles and norms that should be set up so that the internet is right. The trick about that definition is that there are so many people involved in this. So it's not only for the government to call the shots, as we say, when it comes to setting up policies. It's a combination of efforts among various stakeholders, and that includes the government, the private sector, and the average general citizen, that is me, you, your mom, my mom, and so on, and we call that civil society. Obviously, academia has a role as well, because these are the people who almost, you know, analyze and look at how internet use impacts, you know, the future, or, you know, the societal happenings, you know, in our lives. So that's what it is about. So it's not only about the technical stuff that nobody understands. It's looking at various angles of how the internet should be managed in a way that would maintain the interests of everybody.
Yeah, and that's a great area to look at. When I was researching some of your background to prepare for our talk today, I saw a publication that you did, which was called "Whose Internet Is It Anyway? Shaping the Internet: Women's Voices in Governance Decision Making in the Middle East and North Africa." So when you mention internet governance and principles and norms, I guess one of the complexities that you face, varying perspectives and varying norms, and that may be from nation to nation, region to region, you know, gender to gender in some regions. So can you pull that apart and just give us a sense of the complexity in coming to get coming to agreements with multi-stakeholders are involved?
Yeah, it is a real challenge to get people involved. One, because of, you know, the knowledge gap, and obviously the resources gap, I call it. So it's not only about affording, you know, to get a degree in the topic, or be able to trot the world just like all of us do, because we're part of this field. There's a lot of traveling involved, and you need a budget for that, and not anybody can afford it. And also, there are other challenges like visa issues and so on. So to get the masters involved in this field, including, you know, women, it's extremely, extremely difficult, because you really need a lot of people to understand what it is about, to be able to contribute to the policymaking processes. That's for sure, because if you have one voice advocating for a specific process or a framework, it's not enough. And that applies not only on normal people like me and you, it applies on entities. You find a lot of institutions, for example, whom work is related to the field, but they either don't know that these processes exist, or they lack the human resources to be able to contribute. And that's why a lot of the work that I do is specific to engagements, so to engage in with different parties, to understand that they need to air the voice, so all the policies that are being implemented are actually inclusive. Now, this might sound abstract, but there are a lot of, you know, activities based on which we use the internet, but we end up, you know, having to abide by certain rules that are implemented in a top-down manner, and we're not involved in that decision. So you understand what I'm coming from. So all the decisions that are made and specific to how the internet is run in any context will need to be inclusive, and to do that, people will have to understand the key role they can play in that and how to do it.
Do you have I guess an example of a project, maybe, because the overarching emphasis within your work is on internet governance. Do you have a project within that larger, the broader category that you can give an example of mobilizing, you know, different people within a region, pulling them together to affect a positive outcome, policy-wise, or, you know, nation-state policy-wise even? Do you have any examples that we could explore?
I largely, you know, worked on various programs, but I think one of the recent experiences was to actually initiate, design and implement a large scale program on the issue for the Middle East and on North Africa, where we had to basically build the capacity of various stakeholders in the issue to help them create policies in an inclusive manner. So the results of the program is that we managed to like bridge that gap between the different stakeholders, you know, like civil society and the government, knowing that the way things are done in the Middle East are mostly top down. So we try to, you know, initiate the knowledge so people understand what topics are at stake and what are the points, you know, in the system overall, be it legislation, be it, you know, how consultation processes are taking place. So there are various layers that we can work on, but we always start by, you know, information sourcing or building the capacity of the stakeholders in the specific topic. So that was an example. But I'm also involved in other regions, like in Africa, where I did a lot of work with government officials on the same topic. Because while there is like local, national, you know, issues, if I may say, or national processes, there is also the global process, which is quite focused on northern, let's say, countries, or there is more representation from the north than the south. I hate this kind of classification, but that's the truth. So you don't see as many African government officials, for example, participating in the UN process as much as you see, you know, governments from Europe or North America. So that's just an example. There is a need to mobilize from everywhere to be able to address, you know, the gaps which you outlined earlier, like the gender gap, the north-south gap, and so on. So this is in a nutshell. Why is it important? It's important because the internet is basically the now and the future. If people, you know, don't understand how it works, how it can impact their lives, then it would be more problematic, you know, to address, you know, specific issues which emerge. When, for example, we've seen Facebook, you know, making it the first global, let's say, social network, people never anticipated, you know, the content issues that are now at the front pages of, you know, or all these controversies about how they manage this content, how you know, Facebook triggers situations that's honestly good for us, you know, for our lives. So these kinds of, you know, issues, I feel people should have a say in. Not everybody obviously should or must understand this, but at least have a basic kind of understanding of how these things work. What is the link between, you know, technology and how it impacts our lives in general?
Just on that point about Facebook, I mean, we recently saw, I think, what, a couple of weeks ago, that they were slapped with a $5 billion fine. You know, if you look at sort of Facebook's profits, then they'll be able to shrug that off within a couple of quarters or even a quarter. But I think that's, you know, that's a major jump from what various collection of market states or nation states were doing previously, because I think now they understand the gravity of the level of responsibility that these players have forced upon the world and now have. Do you see that as a positive act? I mean, given the fact that they will shrug that off in, you know, write that down out of their profit, or do you see that as a really important symbolic move to, you know, to force players into improving?
Well, $5 billion is no symbolic move, in my opinion. I think if I read well, their profit for this year, it's not even like $2 billion. I'm sure they're not going to have a problem paying the fine, but the issue is actually not in the money. The issue is with their business model. What's happening with governments now, they are literally brushing off the responsibility from their shoulders and putting all the liability on Facebook. But Facebook cannot regulate, you know. I think that Facebook is almost being considered now as a government of itself, like a nation of itself. And that is not a good sign. So I think governments should put more effort into finding robust mechanisms or frameworks, legal or norms, to be able to see how, you know, they can work with Facebook's business model, because ultimately they just want to make money. That's what I say all the time. In terms of setting principles and rules and regulations and all that doesn't come into the equation of how they develop their products. Of course, imposing a fine might be a move, you know, to limit their strength, but I don't think it's the right solution. What we need to do is to be able to come up with a framework based on which, you know, Facebook is working, you know, within certain boundaries to develop even their technology. The thing is, nobody knows how their technology is developed. So I'm not saying limiting innovation, but we definitely need to study how the technology or the algorithm they develop impacts, you know, people. Because this is what's missing at the moment. The human factor is missing when we develop any new technology. And that's why we're unable to foresee how to regulate it or how to put, let's say, a framework. Again, I don't want control. I don't want to encourage, you know, thinking that regulation is the answer to everything. As in also technology is, and this is very, very hard because it's impossible to predict how a specific software is going to behave for the simple reason is it's created for purely lucrative purposes. And you never know how it impacts, you know, our political lives, for example. Like, I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg, when he created Facebook, he didn't think that he will be able to fiddle with the elections, you know, in the UK or in the US. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So technology is far reaching than our understanding, you know, of the now. So we have to be more open, you know, in the way we look at technology, but at the same time, we need to have safeguards to make sure that specific human rights are not basically at stake.
Yeah, and also, you know, that Mark Zuckerberg is at the end of the day.
So he basically, it's a business. It's not a charity. It's not a government.
Okay. So let's, I'd also like to look at women's voices in governance decision making in the Middle East and North Africa. Now, this was a paper that you wrote in 2013. So 6 years ago, I'll put a link to that in the podcast because I enjoyed the read. It's not too easy to read. It's something that people can refer to for this. How do you think things have changed over the last 6 years in this region? And what have you been working on in this region in particular with in terms of building women's, empowering women within the ICT field and with the internet governance field?
We definitely see let's say, incrementally an increased number of women who are interested in technology in general, but there is a wide impression that this is just a man's field. And you can see that clearly. Recently, I was lecturing at the technical school in Morocco. Coincidentally, they just called me to lecture on one of the topics, and I had like 6 or 7 PhD students, women who didn't know what to do with their PhD when they graduate. And they're excellent, very talented, but they still need guidance because they don't see a space for them in this field. And all I do, you know, for the last, you know, 10 years or so is trying to convince women that they can make it, they can do it. And this is not only specific to a region, this is worldwide, because women in technology is still, it's a topic actually that that is very close to my heart, and we're experiencing a lot of challenge convincing big companies to have women in their boards, in their management, or even be involved at the government level or in the policy-making process. There is a lot more work that needs doing in order to, you know, build the confidence of women to be able to be part of the technology field in general. I don't see a lot of change, you know, in 10 years, simply because there is a stigma in general. Yeah. How women, you know, are perceived in high positions, specifically in tech companies. There is obviously the exceptions. Mm. But I can't say there is a significant improvement when it comes to using, you know, ICT in general in women empowerment. So the topics always revolve around societal issues rather than the hardcore tech issues.
Yeah.
And this is purely, you know, linked to the nature of women, which is unfortunate. It's just like we still hear about, you know, archaic problems of our humanity, like racism and so on. This is one of the other stereotypes that more efforts should be done to actually eradicate. So women are not only good in the kitchen or to look after the kids, they might be as you know, equally qualified, you know, to do highly skilled jobs in the technology field.
Yeah. If you look at some, can you think of any examples in the past? I think you mentioned the 10-year time period. There hasn't been much, you know, to shift the needle. Can you think of any use cases which have been successful, which people are pushing and exploring that that kind of defy the weight of non success?
Well, obviously, yes. I come across a lot of women, you know, worldwide, who are trying, you know, to move things, you know, ahead and using technology to do this. And I think one of them is from Pakistan. She's a good friend of mine. Igat, that she was also on Time magazine cover, I think, once. And she's a lawyer, and she's really good, and she's doing a lot of work about women harassment on the internet and offline. So she has her own NGO, and I think she's definitely a good example of an accomplished woman who's trying, you know, to use everything, you know, all her skills, soft skills or hard skills, because she's a qualified lawyer. And I think that's a one example that jumps into my head.
Yeah,
and there are others.
Yeah. I think I mean by an example, not just say an individual woman, but maybe a methodology or framework that she's using to foster and build. And you mentioned the NGO, her creation of NGO. What type of work is that NGO doing? Is I guess more my question, and the level of efficacy. Are they working with young girls to code? Are they going? Is it an NGO with more of a governmental slant to as a lobbyer? You know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, actually. So training is a crucial component of their work, and the focus is actually is on preventing harassment online against women. Because
okay.
In Pakistan, it's quite a hot topic, and simply, you know, there is a need for that kind of work to be done. So I mean, when you know what it is, when you have an NGO, you have to pretty much work with everybody.
Yeah.
Just like I had to do as well when I run my program, you know, on the subject for the Middle East and North Africa, I had to sit with ministers, with, you know, with pretty much everybody who can, you know, make a change one way or another. And that's the beauty of it, is that you get the opportunity to sit down with change makers, with, you know, implementers, with voices, you know, just general voices. I learned a lot, you know, from the youth in the Middle East when I was doing my work on the ground, because I was pretty much not an office kind of manager type of work that I wanted to lead.
Yeah.
I wanted to be on the ground and work with people closely to understand, you know, what are the issues at stake and how we can help, you know, solving them. Of course, the solution is not there, because impacts of programs usually are measured in the long run. You know, you need a 10-year span, you know, to be able to see the result that you worked on. But the most important thing for me was to have the basic criteria to work with, and that is very motivated youth, the space to do it, because it's not easy, you know, to do work in the Middle East. So you need sometimes licenses and so on just to organize meetings. So more or less that was accessible. So there are a lot of challenges that you can come across when you're, you know, leading work of this sort, you know, to expand knowledge or build capacity or raise awareness and so on, especially if the work led by a foreign entity as well.
Yeah.
So it's not straightforward. But again, we try, you know, to lead the work in a transparent way. And I think I'm lucky because I managed to build excellent relationships with different, you know, government people and parliamentarians because there was positive, you know, reception to the importance of having people from our region, you know, from the Middle East involved in the policymaking process. Why? Because there is a risk that, you know, a very small minority of people are in charge, you know, of our field when it comes to the importance to having it inclusive where everybody is represented, because the internet is for everyone and it should remain, you know, accessible and open and available for everyone. There shouldn't be like a small minority of people or organizations in charge of running it on behalf of the whole world. Why? Because its use impacts all of us. So that's how I see it personally. I'm not sure if you relate to it, but I can say it's quite important. So all our future is on the internet. So we better have a say on how it's managed and how it's governed.
Absolutely. Well, there's two things that spring to mind, first things first, I absolutely agree. The difficulty though is when you're looking at, say, different nation states who the collection of people who are in control aren't as inclusive as other regions. And it reminds me of did you know Benga Sessan from the Paradigm Initiative? I think he was speaking as well.
Yeah.
And I read a report. You would certainly know the statistics. I imagine you'll know the statistics much better than I can, because I can't even spout any of the statistics out. But it was a look at the different levels of transparency, openness, and surveillance in different African nations. And some were, you know, over the past 10 years, it's seen a lot of improvement, a lot of involvement and engagement with civil society, with citizenry, with external stakeholders, and yet others were completely the opposite. So I guess, you know, that's the perennial difficulty though, I guess, and that's it's not exactly a new story.
No. But also the level of engagement varies. There are governments who would like to work, for example, on their overall strategy, let's say, related to economy. And, you know, if you want to foster foreign direct investments, you need to have the convenient environment for other companies to come invest in your country and so on. So you either have to abide by specific, you know, international instruments which guarantee that the country is using, you know, due diligence when it comes to using, for example, data, or they have, you know, laws and frameworks in place that would, you know, put the investors' minds at rest and ensure that their money is going into more or less democratic kind of system. And when things go wrong, there is some kind of accountability.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I think a lot of African countries now they have, you know, their own strategies, including maybe a vision on their digital strategy, which keeps an eye on these important elements. So the countries that are open to business, they want to align, you know, with these specific procedures, and others need a little bit more convincing because they can't see yet the added value of having mechanism in place. And that's why, again, I go back to the same point, engagement is very important. And until you get that maybe pass to have access to governments to convince them, it's hard work. I can confirm that, because not everybody understands, you know, the added value of having an open internet. And that's why you see a lot of African countries shutting down the internet when there is some kind of unrest. They maybe not up to date when it comes to how it impacts, for example, the economy.
Yeah,
Or how much money they're losing.
And when that discussion is had, it's been a pretty age old effective carrot and stick maneuver, saying, "Look, you can abide by a better level of and standard of regulation, or there's no foreign direct investment and your economy suffers." It's positive, I guess, that there are governments that are seeking that initial discussion, even if they're not developed. Okay,
yeah,
how do we set aside a framework?
Yeah, more or less it's the case, because we either don't want to be playing catch up all the time. Like the emerging economies, why there is always business for global multinational companies and emerging economies, because they're always playing catch up with anything and everything, including technology.
Yeah.
We talk about, for example, having these countries connected to the internet as a basic thing, you know, to be plugged, you know, to be on air, like we're doing now. But they say, oh, no, well, we need bread first. We need to have water. We need education. Unfortunately, you know, for these countries, they will have to be in a position to think about all these issues simultaneously. There is no, oh, let me do this first and then I get connected to the internet. Otherwise, as I said, you would be always playing catch up. You know, that impacts, you know, the overall future of a whole generation. And that's what we don't want, because we talk about policies or regulation. That's not the big picture. The big picture is to take advantage of, you know, this platform or this infrastructure, which is the internet, to make sure that people live better lives in simple terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Have access to education, better jobs, you know, contribute to, you know, the global development of everything, accessibility, connect with people everywhere, learn, you know, from what other people do at the global level, not be restricted to your own environment or your own village or your own country. And that's, you know, the added value of the internet. So we want it to be free, open and accessible for everybody. Because everybody will benefit from it. So this is like literally in simple terms, simple language that everybody understands. So I don't seem to resist this. So why don't you want it to be in this way? Like,
yeah.
Speak to the most close or narrow-minded, you know, government person in X country, for example. And if you speak to them in these simple terms, I'm sure they will understand it and they'll understand the value of it.
Well, that's half the fun, isn't it?
Well, that's why we all have a job, probably.
Well,
there is a time where you want to just move on and jump to the next challenge, because you can't get stuck sometimes at one thing. So that's why I anticipated this, and I started doing research on blockchain technology. So as I said, you'll always see me, you know, doing new things and topping up my knowledge as I go, because I understand the value of how fast technology evolves, and we need to keep up with it.
Okay, and that's a good point to sort of start closing the conversation. Your work on blockchain, and also where people can find you, because I know that you're very active on the speaker circuit, RightsCon, FOC. But first, yeah, give us a sense of, you know, maybe one of the projects you're working on that involves blockchain, and then we'll go from there.
My interest in blockchain as an emerging economy, it's basically still linking, you know, the regulatory and policy, you know, challenges to deploying it. Of course, it's a very young, let's say, you know, technology, and the work that I've been doing mainly now is with business entities who would like to scale their business and they want to use this emerging technology. And that's maybe part of me wanting to, you know, keep businesses, especially in emerging economies, up to date with what's happening in the technology field. So all I do at the moment with blockchain is help people figure out whether they want the business to be blockchain plugged, yes or no, and help them anticipate, you know, the regulatory and policy challenges that might come with them wanting to ride, you know, the wave of this quite controversial and still disputed concept. Personally, I started researching it, you know, because of my master's, but also because I do believe in the very concepts, because it sounded good to me, in theory, to have a decentralized system where, you know, the power of decision is distributed, which is something that we lack now in various systems, at government level, financial systems, and even in every industry that you can look at. There is a lot of centralization that we probably, as a concept, I'm saying, it sounds really, really, really good, but in practice, we are still figuring out whether that works or no.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of technology. Like, you can always be skeptical, you can question, and you can be part of the solution and the answer. It takes a little bit of research and, you know, being exposed, you know, to new things and wanting to change, because there is a lot of criticism, you know, about the technology itself and other emerging technologies like artificial intelligence or Internet of Things. But I'm afraid we all have to be embracing to these new things, because they might take over our lives in the future. And then when we're put in the middle of the situation, we wouldn't know what to do, because we refused in the past to either deal with it or understand it. So that's what happens constantly, you know, with any technology.
I recorded yesterday with the cyber ambassador for Australia, and I was just thinking, there was part of our discussion where I was thinking about the yin and the yang, and how there's a fair amount of pragmatism on this podcast, and you know, change is inevitable and it will happen whether you like it or not. So you can either adapt or you get left behind, and that in the starkest terms, that means you, for want of a better word, extinct. So
well, humans don't particularly like change, because you set your comfort zone and you just want to function within that comfort zone. But I'm afraid the future is all about, you know, taking risks, being adventurous, being, you know, cool enough to ride the wave and cool enough to just be open to the world, because it's inevitable. Like, we're all connected, you know, to a network now, and everything is accessible. So why not? That's how I see it.
Well, that's a really, I think we'll end on that really positive note. Thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed it. Where can people find you? You know, I guess over the next year, are you doing any more speaking events this year?
Yeah, well, I am part of various events or, you know, stuff that is happening. I'll be mostly working in Africa for the next few months. And I'm also basically present in the UN process when it comes to my expertise and my field of work, and that is internet governance. So there is the annual Internet Governance Forum. It's a UN-led forum, and it's organized this year by Germany. So it's in Berlin, late November. I will be there, and most of, you know, the other work is in different parts of the world. So I'll be moderating workshops and organizing meetings with the business entities in different countries about blockchain adoption. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Hanan Mujemi, or connect with me on LinkedIn under the same name, or, you know, just drop me an email. It's available on my profile. So thank you very much, Nick. I really, really enjoyed this podcast, and I hope your audience will find it interesting enough. And I hope to connect with you again at some point. Actually, Freedom Online Coalition meeting is next year in Ghana. So the government of Ghana is the chair at the moment of the coalition, and they will organize the meeting early next year. I think it's February 2020. In Accra. So,
I'll certainly clear my schedule for that one. That sounds great. Yeah, so
I thought you would be interested in that, since I met you this year in Berlin. So thank you very much, Nick, and I wish you best of luck.
Thank you so much. Cheers for that. Take care. Thank you, Hanan.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.